The following program is pre-recorded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our UFO show. I'm Jerry Pippin, and tonight we're going to feature something coming up over the weekend. And that's a tribute to one of the finest UFO conferences ever. That's the Ozark UFO Conference, 23rd year in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. It's always been a wonderful conference with lots of major speakers, and this year it's no different. Travis Walton will be. We have many interviews with Travis and on our website if you'd like to go over and check him out sometime. JerryPippin.com. Enter into the search mechanism Travis Walton or go to the gallery of guests, either way, and you can find him. Very interesting fellow indeed, and a very nice fellow. We've been interviewing Travis ever since Fire in the Sky, the original movie, and that goes back a ways. Other people who will be there this year, Richard Seifert will be there. And we have an interview with him that we did several years ago. He was a forest ranger and ran across Bigfoot and UFO together. Interesting fellow. Kathy Martin will be there as well. You know, she has a big observation or anniversary coming up later on in the year on the Betty and Barney Hill incident. Can you believe it's been 50 years? Anyway, she will be making a speech setting the record straight. Other people that will be there this year, in addition, is the fellow who was at Aztec, and now he's at Eureka Springs, and that's Stephen Jones, who has 50 years of abduction experience. There's another Jones also, Ryan Jones, talking about hostile entities, which is one of my favorite subjects. I believe there are more hostile ones out there than you might want to accept. And we'll have to get Ryan on the air sometime. We've never talked to him. Others that will be there this year include John Major Jenkins. And he's going to take a look at 2012 and a little different look at it. Can you believe 2012 is almost here? So I guess we'll find out pretty soon whether or not we know what we're talking about when we talk about the end of the Mayan calendar. It may be just that. It may be something else. Linda Moulton Howe, always a great speaker and a great person. And she is a regular at the Eureka Springs Affair, it seems. I think she's been there every year. And she's talking this year about time travel. Richard Dolan has a speech he's been given around the country called After Disclosure, AD. And he'll be there. Rich is always an interesting fellow. And Peter Davenport, Are We Alone in Our Galaxy, is his subject. And as you know, Peter Davenport is one of the better-known people that compiles weekly research on sightings reports. That's all at Eureka Springs at the Ozark UFO Conference. It will be at the end of the Ozarks. And you can just drop in there, or you can go over to their website either way and make a reservation. It's not expensive. It's great facilities there. And we would recommend that you maybe go. Okay, we've done a plug for them, so I think I'm entitled to feature some of our previous shows that we've done from this conference in Eureka Springs at the end of the Ozarks. First off, we're going to play an interview with Sam Marento, one of our favorite people. And Sam, in this interview, is going to be talking to us about a fellow up in Wisconsin that has strange creatures, including UFOs, on his property. And he can't seem to get many people to pay attention to it. Listen to this show. It's very interesting. And after that, we have Paul Von Ward. Later on, Grant Cameron and David Rubiak. But first, let's do this interview with Sam Maranto. Well, here we are at the Ozark UFO Festival, and I call it a festival because it's so much fun here in Eureka Springs. And we have a witness of that who took a lot of fun with him last night, Sam Maranto.
Oh, yeah, I'm feeling the fun today.
Yeah. Actually, they have a little get-together after everything's over here at this little, I don't know the name of the place, a club or a bar or whatever.
They call it the... the something saloon, the Lone Star Saloon.
Yeah, that's it, the Lone Star Saloon.
Yeah, and I'm feeling the kick of the Lone Star today.
And of course, you didn't have that much, folks. It's just the fact that you're not used to that.
No, I'm not a drinker, so I had myself a couple drinks and wanted to salute the other guys that were here and done a great job. And tied up in the festivity.
Yeah,
I guess.
The only reason I mentioned is not to say that the director on in Illinois is drunk. it was the fact that's one of the important things about these conferences is camaraderie, and you get to meet each other, and you've known each other,
sure,
and you get to see each other in person, and it's.
And that's a perfect, you know, like we were talking earlier, here we talk to these people via internet, or we see each other in documentaries, or hear about certain cases over the internet, radio, television, whatever. But it's rarely an occasion we get to see each other. Here you have Timothy Good coming in from England to the Ozarks. Mm-hmm. This is a fine gentleman, takes his time, actually spends money to get here. I mean, the end result is these trips cost you money, you know, for these speakers.
Sure.
And I think it's a labor of the heart.
Well, sure it is. No doubt about it. We get a lot of things that we've talked about over the years. And how is our friend Sean doing up in Wisconsin these days?
Sean and Robin are doing very well. And I try to speak to them at least once a week. We used to speak, as you recall, back in the heyday of all the strange stuff going on. We used to speak a couple times a day. But he's doing really well. Things are really coming to a degree of control, normalcy, whatever you want to call it. I think the whole interaction of this very strange event to them was uplifting in the long run, though it was extremely frightening,
unusual.
Right.
And if they want to know what we're talking about, and we're going to get you a little closer to that mic simply because of the background noise here, is the fact that we have an interview of Sean on our website that you can go to. And click on it. It's still there. We did it several years ago. And Sam got involved in the investigation. And some of those things are really phenomenal.
Yes, hands down.
What's happening there?
Jared, those things, I'm saying things on tape that I've only heard about. In other words, phenomena with UFOs coming out of the clouds, rotating triangular disks, objects that look like carpenter's angles, rectangles, etc., actually coming out of clouds, rotating, giving off their own illusion of clouds, atmospheric disturbance, etc. And he has this all on tape, you know, and we actually sat down, I and his wife, 12 hours of footage.
I've talked to her on the phone, too.
Isn't she a sweetheart?
Quite sincere.
Yeah, she's straightforward. No BS. Yeah. This is a genuine, straightforward
now,
person.
Either you mentioned it to me or he did or somebody, something about it. He needed a flatbed truck at one time. What was that about?
He calls me up on Easter, right?
Yeah.
I'm coming home from, we had a get-together dinner, the whole thing. And so here it was 2 years ago. He calls me up. I'm walking in the door, and the phone's ringing, and he's all hysterical. The tree crawlers are here. Understand, we gave names to each type of unusual creature, and believe me, these things that were there appeared to be living things, and everything that he witnessed seemed to be, these are living things, secreting some type of, I don't know if it's a saliva or what, you know, purpose this the secretion is, but... and they have eyes. I have footage of this stuff he has footage that I've done enhancements on. But we're really holding off on this to have it all analyzed, to have it all assembled, and bring this out as the case that it should be, And this way, it's not going to be debunked, and people aren't going to laugh at it. There's going to be credibility in back of it.
So there will be something that you can see, I guess, if you needed a truck.
Oh, yes. He shot this darn thing, and I don't know how many times he was shooting at it with his high-powered 22. Getting back to that. Thanks for bringing me back there, by the way. And I got off on the track. But I call up John Schuessler. Hey, John, got a guy up here, our guy in Fredericks, shot this thing, and he thinks that he killed it, and it may be falling out of the tree. What should I do with it? He says, well, just go up there, get it, stick it in the bag, bring it to a university, and have him analyze it. I go, wait a minute. We don't have a certain protocol for this. And second of all, the object's so big, I'm in a flatbed truck.
Yeah.
He goes, what? I go, yes. So luckily, what it was, whatever it was still alive, and it moved away. But he did shoot it. He shot at it a couple times. First of all, he thought it was some turkey in the tree. When he looked at it and was moving closer, it was substantially larger than a turkey.
Did it ever fall to the ground?
No, it actually it crawled away, moved through the trees. Uh-huh. And when this thing moves through the trees, it moves the entire trees. And
these are sure, because it's big.
Oh, it's massive. And from what I see, it looks like it does have an eye. Now, if this is some sort of biotechnology, I don't know. But it's truly unusual. It knows how to cloak itself into the environment. And it has scales much like, or skin much like a Gila monster.
Oh, really?
Yes. He calls it, he refers to it, when he sees it, he says it looks like a placosomus, an algae-eating fish that you'd find in a fish tank. They usually come from the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he describes it. It looks like a big placosomus. So what in the heck is this? I don't know. I don't know if the aliens came there because of all this UFO activity and they just let the zoo out to eat. I don't know.
Yeah, right. We understand. Or maybe it's their pet.
It's their pet, yes. Let Fluffy out to do its thing.
Well, some people have boa constrictors as pets.
Yeah, so maybe they got monster placosomus that crawl in trees, and peek in windows, by the way. It does love to go near the windows and watch them. But that's the type of unusual activity to boot the usual UFOs, orbs, extremely large craft. The other thing is, he may have told you about the object that was hovering over his house for days on end, and it looked like a hole in the sky, and it had notches on it. He referred to it as if it was bit by a shark, and I finally tried. The thing is, people talk only within their own realm of experience. Well, his terminology is far different than what I was able to, relate to, and actually Rob helped quite a bit in determining.
Rob Kutowski in Phoenix. And we have another show coming up, Rob, and we'll see him this fall as well. Maybe you can come out to Chicago. I'm from Chicago out to Phoenix.
I hope to. I've been threatening him. I'm going to be down there doing some
research.
Well,
maybe we can all get there at the same time.
That's the best thing. And what we've been, during that whole episode, these things were going on simultaneously, Fredericks and the events out there in Arizona. So I would have Sean on the line with Rob, and the funny thing is the two of them were talking about the same things, describing it a little bit different. For instance, these unusual tubes that looked like lucite tubes. They would be there, and it looks like to me, from what I'm seeing, some sort of webbing or fabric of possible dimensional fabric. So some of these experiments or experiences may have to do with dimensional objects.
Yeah, we've been out to Rob's house, and there's definitely something going on, and it might be interdimensional. It just kind of shows up, creeps around.
Well, you saw it firsthand. It scared the hell out of you.
No doubt about it. And Sean, he and his wife are scared a lot. I think
yes.
They've calmed down a little bit now. But
They calmed down. My wife, Julie, and I, we went up there to see them, and we just love them. They're like family to us, they have a daughter there, which is, of course, his main concern. You have to realize, during this whole episode, he was going through what would be post-traumatic stress disorder, And part of that is the hypervigilance where you're staying.
Well, actually, that probably enabled him to see some more of that stuff, probably.
He was able to stay up at night because he wouldn't go to bed.
Uh-huh.
The other thing is, of course, we had mentioned the implants in his eyes, and I'm sure he mentioned that too. Vic Connor went up there in November. I had to go down to the Ozarks. It was both a trip and an investigation. So I was gone, but I was able to monitor the investigation.
Yeah.
Vic Connor went up there during that period of time, said that there was two metallic objects that were, I believe, hexagon shape as far as the drawings, in next to the iris, an exact location, both eyes. By the time I got to see him later, I believe it was November, and he came down to the house, as he had a couple times. There was actually a growth over it. In other words, the eye covered it up with its own growth, and it was no longer visible. But I had asked him prior to this to go into the bathroom and use a black light to look over himself, and he says, what am I supposed to look for? Well, you know, I would never reveal what you're supposed to look for. I don't know if there's anything there. I just want you to tell me what you see. And he saw these objects in his eye just glowing. And it's much unlike any sort of eye injury. Usually a scar tissue will also do that, or a bacteria in the eye. You'll have some sort of luminescence. It was truly different and in the same location.
Wow.
But since that point, he's been able to see, it appears to be, and we're going to have to do further tests, but he's able to see wider ranges of the infrared and the ultraviolet from what I could detect so far. And if we could play this out through, prove it through some experimentation, I think it'll be interesting. The other thing is those items have been seen in his eye by an optometrist, and, yes, they are there.
You've been up to Wisconsin. I get the idea that they live pretty far out someplace.
They're about a mile out of a very nice town, relatively small. It's an extremely wooded area, and it's also part of what would be the Ice Age trail, which means that this area was not destroyed in the last glacial period, which I believe, Never Kick Indian Woman, isn't it? And so it was Wisconsin period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful area, a lot of ferns.
It's isolated.
Oh, it's isolated. But it's not to the point that, it's thousands of miles or hundreds of miles, or for that matter, even 10 miles away from civilization. He has people literally across the street and probably about a quarter mile from each other.
Any of those other people see anything?
Absolutely. This is an area that has a history of UFO activity. A major sighting was seen literally in the town over the lake. And one gentleman started telling him about it, but we're trying to find historical documents on that. There was also a very large and well-known case in the 50s where a hairy, small humanoid was seen actually just down the road from him. So, and that's a known case. And I don't know if it's an ICAP case or I don't know. I'd have to find out.
What's the name of that town Sean lives in?
Fredericks.
Okay. In case somebody wanted to check it out on a map or something.
Check it out on a map. Don't go up there.
Yeah, right.
Don't bother the man. remember what the thing in the tree got? You might get it too. So don't go bother the man.
That's not something that a lot of curiosity seekers should be around, I don't think.
Well, he had people bothering him, but these people were driving around in black Suburbans with whip antennas, and they came right up to his property.
That doesn't sound like a tourist.
No, it sounds like a agency of some sort. And then they had one of these fiber optic telescopes peeking through the floor. The wife, Robin, called me up in tears, screaming and saying, what are they doing? What's going on? I'll tell you what, I lived through this, obviously, at a distance, at a comfortable distance, and still felt the terror these people were going through. And not every every UFO experience or extraterrestrial contact is something that's going to be a very comforting experience. Some are terrifying.
Some of them they're scarred for life. Others are, of course, it's all life changing. But I don't know. I don't know if we could put a percentage on it or not. Maybe half and half, or 80%, 60%. really have repercussions.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I would say so.
Yeah, that of course, don't hold us to that statistic,
no.
folks.
No.
We haven't. It's the Jerry Pippin Institute of Knowledge, so you can take that for what it's worth. Sam Maranto is our guest, and, of course, he is the director of MUFON for Illinois. And it's about a 10-hour drive from Chicago down here, I think.
So. It's a pleasurable ride, usually. And some, you know, this is what I'm going to do right now is actually give a little bit of good tiding for this group here. This is a magnificent group of people. First of all, if you haven't been down here, do it. It's a reasonable, I'd say highly enjoyable, but reasonable conference compared to many others. And all are good. Remember, all are good. But this one here has got a certain feel about it. And, boy, I love it. It's great.
Oh,
you've been here so many
people
times.
Keep coming back that come.
Yeah. And then Lou just does a fantastic job putting this together.
And let's give the MUFON website, or does Illinois have something separate?
Illinois has its own website. We're still redoing it. The mm-hmm. other thing is, if you would like to get in contact with me, you can always call me at 708-460-7606. Again, that is 708-460-7606. Check out the MUFON site, the international site, which is www.mufon.com. If you'd like to file a report there, you can do it. It's very convenient. It'll be forwarded to whichever director it needs to go to. And, Jared, thank you very much.
I've enjoyed it. You have a safe trip back to Chicago, and we'll be talking soon, and maybe we'll see each other in Phoenix.
I hope so, my friend.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
It's Jerry Pippin, and we are in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and we're talking with Paul Vaughn Ward, who has a book out called God's Genes and Consciousness is the correct title. Paul, that's the least I could do is give the correct title for your book. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Well, that's meant to be alliterative, you know, God's Genes and Consciousness. It has a good ring to it.
Yeah, well, now, you actually have a very interesting subject, and we're going to go into it in great detail here. Your thesis or hypothesis or actual philosophy or whatever is that this has been going on for a long time.
That's true. What I've done is take as a hypothesis that the stories told in the sacred texts, I mean the Bible, the Sumerian text, Egyptian texts, and so on, and all the traditional stories that societies tell about their origins and where information came from, knowledge and wisdom, if you take that as not fanciful, you know, imaginings of ancient people, but as descriptions of something of the truth and the reality they experienced. So the hypothesis is that's history.
Well, it sounds logical to me, and you start putting these things together, and all of a sudden, you're probably right on.
Well, you know, what happens is once you start building from that early era, and thinking of the so-called gods and aliens and demons and angels and so on, it leads you right to the current day with our own experience today of contacts and communications with other beings and all levels of consciousness.
Let's get into this then a little bit. Basically, right off the bat, when we're talking about UFOs, what are we really talking about here?
Well, I think UFOs are, you know, they're in different categories. I use the term ABs or advanced beings for all levels of consciousness. Some of them may be flesh and blood, I mean, you know, in the electromagnetic spectrum that we live in and work in, but others may be interdimensional or multidimensional apparitions or contacts with humans that we see and communicate with through our own inner senses.
Well, we'll call them ABs, since that's what you call
them. Well, I like that, because it's a better sound than alien or ET, you know.
Well, yeah, it certainly is, and it kind of covers the subject with a couple of words there, which is important.
Well, it's like it permits us to compare apples to apples rather than talking apples and oranges, and that's what divides people, you know. You're talking about ETs, and I'm talking about angels, and so we don't talk to each other.
And meanwhile, we're probably talking about the same thing.
We're talking about the same thing. If you look at the descriptions of the experiences in the Bible, in ancient text, they're very similar to the descriptions that we have today.
You're absolutely right. The first time I became aware of this was the old book years ago called Spaceships of Ezekiel.
That's exactly right. That's a perfect example.
And you start thinking about that, but you go back in your book, you talk about the Sumerians and the Hebrews and on and on.
On and on. I mean, the descriptions are there. And actually, I don't claim credit for this, you know. Raymond Fowler was one in one of his books who listed...
I had Raymond on the air here a while back.
Well, he has a list of like 25 or 30 examples from the Bible that correspond to current reports. And the descriptions are the same, so that's why I say they're apples to apples. We're not talking about different phenomena, we're talking about similar phenomena.
And it's been going on since humankind.
I would say from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I sort of agree with Zachariah Sitchin's interpretations of the Sumerian text that, you know, the Anunnaki in Sumerian, the Anakim in Hebrew in the Bible, were involved in the early stages of human development. I don't think they created humans, but they certainly intervened in human development at a genetic level.
Well, I can see, in fact, we just had recently a report from Brazil about some beings that had red eyes and were somewhat brownish in tone and skin tone, probably, and the natives down there thought they were devils.
Yes, yes.
And through human history, especially... mankind before we reached our so-called sophistication of today, which is debatable, and I don't want to get into an argument about it.
Well, we might have an agreement there, because I think we've had some devolution rather than evolution.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you on that, too. The point is that they could very well be angels and demons, and we're talking about the ABs.
Right. Well, if you go back to the Book of Enoch, you know, which was discovered in the
sure.
Dead Sea Scrolls, and it was not included in the official Christian and Judeo sacred texts, but it describes this history of how we started using this concept of demons and angels and the good guys and the bad guys. And they were really advanced beings who had a disagreement about how to interact with humans. And actually, those who were called sinners, because they were under the god sin,
yes.
were the ones who were trying to help humans by giving us information and knowledge and so on to help us advance.
Somewhat like we have today in political and history context, what you say is sometimes usually just the opposite.
Just the opposite. It's been turned in reverse. So the good guys are now the bad guys.
Right, and so where are we going with this?
Well, where we're going, I think, what I'm trying to do, I call myself a cosmic puzzle master.
I like that term, too. You're full of it today.
I'm trying to fill in the blanks in a crossword puzzle, you know, of what I call an interdisciplinary cosmology. We've had a lot of good work done in the UFO field. We've had a lot of work done in parapsychology. We've had a lot of work done in quantum physics, a lot of good work done in parapsychology. But those disciplines are kept separate. And what I've tried to do in my little interdisciplinary approach, and that's what I do in Gods and Genes and Consciousness, is to bring them together and say, how do these corroborate one another? How do they confirm this hypothesis of AB intervention in human history?
In other words,
and I think it's fantastic, the amount of material that is in correlation.
Yeah, there's plenty out there if you stop and think about all the religious documents, fine literature, some not so fine literature, but they're all based on the same thing.
Based on the same thing. And then you go back and look. What I try to do is take that literature, but go back and also look at the fossil record. What are the archaeologists and paleontologists?
I want to talk to you about that because you bring that up in your book, and I noticed that a little earlier when I knew you were coming by.
Right.
You say there's actual fossil, I guess, proof that we're talking about alien intervention.
AB intervention. I mean,
yeah.
there are several, you know, missing links in the fossil record. I mean, when you jump from Homo erectus to Homo sapiens, there's a big gap. This happened so suddenly about 300,000 years ago that you cannot explain that leap in terms of evolutionary theory, which is hypothesized to be about a 2% change over a million years. And when this happens in a few hundred years or a thousand or so years,
you can't explain it that way.
And same thing happened when you go from early humans to Homo sapiens sapiens. Mm-hmm. You had the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon and Homo sapiens all together, and I think Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal are really subspecies mm-hmm. of the Homo sapiens species. But when you have these gaps, you can't explain it. And you look at the dates of those gaps, and they correspond with the Sumerian story of intervention by advanced beings about 300,000 years ago. Also, the bringing of those humanoid beings from Africa to the Middle East, to the Garden of Eden area, about 100,000 years ago. And lo and behold, we discover fossils in the Middle East where we say these are the first Caucasoids,
mm-hmm.
and that's 100,000 years ago. And you look at the genetic research, where the phylogenetic trees have been developed to project back when did these different groups of humans break off from the mainstream out of Africa. You arrive about the same dates. 100,000 years ago, Caucasoids, 50,000 or so years ago, the Mongoloids. And this coincides with the development of AB involvement, according to the literature, in human civilization.
Well, you know, you talk about this in your book a little bit, and I wanted to ask you something about, we talk about disclosure these days.
Right.
We're talking about the government's hiding it.
Right,
And then on the other hand, I just, you know, half of my shows or a third of them, I've talked to people who've been, you think they've been abducted or they have been or they had some sort of contact or something.
Right, exactly.
It seems to me that maybe, and somebody told me you said this once, that they both had the same goals. That's the reason they work hand in hand, these people. The ABs like the secrecy. And so is the government.
Well, I think there are some ABs who like the secrecy, and the government, of course, likes it. But see, my issue in this book in particular, I mean, I've had looked at the problem from different perspectives, but in this particular instance, I think the reason we have government cover-up, and it's not government cover-up per se, it's really the powerful interests that are economic, political, religious forces mm-hmm. that really operate behind the scenes. But these folks don't want to talk about a cover-up. And if it were just a few ETs and UFOs out there, there would be nothing wrong with saying, oh, well, we've been studying them for the last 50 years.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But it's more than that, because if you admit to that suppression and cover-up,
you assault the religion and everything
the
else.
The whole story of history, mm-hmm. you see, is exposed. Uh-huh. So to me, that's the fundamental motivation for keeping this story under the wraps.
Well, who's the greatest threat here? The ABs or the government?
Well, I think the greatest threat is humans on humans.
Ourselves.
Exactly.
We are the enemy.
We are the enemy. I mean, I think that, you know, I conclude towards the end of the book that, you know, there are a lot of experiences and interventions that are considered to be hostile and negative and so on, but the majority of the reports are really positive and benevolent, offering good advice to humans about what to do about the environment and all those kind of things. So I conclude that in the majority we have ABs who are either interested in supporting human development, helping us solve our problems, not directly, but with advice and insight and so forth, and they're observing the prime directive. I mean, they're keeping a little bit hands-off. Now, I think there are some ABs, for example, that do want to take advantage of us and may collaborate with secret parts of our government.
When you talk about taking advantage, I'm going to get to the majority in just a second, but when you're talking about taking advantage, our natural resources or something?
This is a garden planet in our solar system and in our galaxy, and it offers a way station for beings from elsewhere to take advantage of the resources that we have here, to take advantage of the hospitality, if you please, of our natural planet. And there's also, you know, as I'm sure you know and all of us know who've read some of the reports, there are reports that people are, not people, but other humanoid-like beings are taking advantage of our energy, of our psychic energy.
Zapping our energy field and the vampire story, literally taking blood, and then you have cattle mutilations, human mutilations reported.
Well, those I see more as experimental and studying, just like we do lesser species ourselves. I mean, you know, we go into the wild and we treat them the same way we're being treated.
We think nothing of tagging a wild animal, and they probably think nothing of tagging us.
Exactly. I mean, we have to think of it in those terms.
Yeah, I didn't even interrupt you. We're on a roll there. about where you were headed.
Well, the point I was trying to make in this book, drawing all this together, is I'm trying to make the point that, sure, there are ABs, there's been intervention in human history, but that's history, and what we have to do now is to think about our own responsibility for our reactions. What do we do with that information and that knowledge? I'm a psychologist in my early career, and, you know, when you have a person that has a fragmented personality, multiple personality syndrome or disorder, as we now call it, MPD, you have to go back and find the authentic self, help the person find their natural core, and then integrate this information from the various factions into a whole. And I think that's where we are as a fragmented species, divided among ourselves.
And evidently the ABs are fragmented.
Absolutely. And we have to get our own act together as a species. It seems to me, in terms of dealing with this planet and the threat that we are to our own ecosystem.
Well, Paul Von Ward, you've got a scientific background, as you said, psychologist. How'd you get interested in this subject? I mean, a lot of your friends probably figure this is way out.
I know they do. I've had a checkered career. I started out as a good Southern Baptist minister as a young man, and then I went into graduate school in psychology.
Well, it sounds like my history. I wasn't the minister, but everybody in my family was.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
I was the outcast, the radio guy.
Well, I started that way, and then I was in graduate school and studying clinical psychology, and I got more interested in parapsychology than the traditional classes that were there, because I always had this interest in what is on the edge of knowledge that people are not paying attention to. And I had an intuitive sense that, you know, that's where the next stage of development is, on the frontier, on the edges. But I got in the Navy in the early 60s, like a lot of us, getting in the military, serving our country and all that sort of thing, and became a naval officer for a few years. But then I got an appointment by Lyndon Johnson to be a diplomat in the Foreign Service. So that took 15 years of serving in the State Department and overseas.
And where are you basically?
Well, I served in France and in Martinique and Dominican Republic and West Africa and in Washington and in NATO.
Well, about the only French I know is je ne sais pas.
Well, French was my first foreign language. I speak French and Spanish, a little bit of Russian, and I speak a lot of Southern.
I understand that. So, you go from the Foreign Service to what do we call ABs in that service? You might be an ambassador to them.
Well, people ask me, what's a psychologist doing in the Foreign Service in the State Department? I said, can you think of a better place to have...
I think that's probably a pretty good qualification.
Pretty good qualification.
So they can say what they want to about Lyndon Johnson, but he was smart enough to get you into that.
Well, I don't know whether they consider it smart enough. My colleagues now have sort of turned me out from their circles because... Really, when you start making connections, not only with the UFO, ET phenomenon, but questioning this whole history of our institutions, I mean, I make everybody mad. I mean, you know, it's in the church.
You're an equal opportunity.
I'm an iconoclast. Yeah. It doesn't matter what sacred cow, I take a look at it.
Well, I personally think that's pretty healthy.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think raising the question, in other words, people say, how can you do this after the certainty of your religious beliefs? And I said, now I've reached a point where my certainty is based on a sense of uncertainty,
yes.
A sense of unknowing. We live in an open-ended universe where the questions are there, and it's continual pursuit, new thinking.
You're the one who brought it up about being a Baptist minister originally.
Well, I didn't mean to throw the conversation off.
I just wanted to ask you something. How does all of this with... your book and the theory, how does that fit in? Are you still religious at all? Or?
Well, I have.
Maybe that's the wrong term.
Religion is a modern invention. I mean, it was invented within the last 2,000 years. Religion comes from the Latin words religare, to reconnect, and religions are connect man back to God. I don't think we were ever separated.
Yeah, I got a good point. I have a fellow who he got out of the Southern Baptist Church, to give you an idea, because it was too conservative enough. I'm sorry. And so it gives you an idea where he is. He happens to be a college professor, retired now, but he literally writes me emails all the time calling me a pagan.
Right.
And things like that.
Well, he doesn't know the origin of pagan. You know where pagan came from?
Let's talk about this.
This was after Christianity had been established as the official religion of Rome. You know, Constantine helped create Christianity with the Nicene Council of 325 A.D., but that only made it one of the official religions of Rome, and actually later on it was then made into the only state religion of Rome, and by that time they started persecuting everybody who wouldn't agree to be a Christian. And so a lot of the people rebelled against that, and they were sent off to part of the Roman Empire called Pagi. P-A-G-I,
uh-huh.
And
that
they were known as pagans.
Right.
So the pagans weren't the first people, you know. The first earlier people were what I call natural spirituality. And that's where I'm at. I believe in natural spirituality.
The name of the book is God's Genes and Consciousness, and we're talking with Paul Von Ward. And Paul, we kind of skimmed over this in the broadcast. You kind of have to. But
sure.
You put a lot of stock into, like, the Egyptian culture and the pyramids. I find that hard to believe that they could build that with slave labor.
Oh, I think that was part of the earlier phase of civilization. That I think some of it even preceded the cataclysm of 11,500 years ago, you know, which is referred to as the flood in the Bible, the deluge and some other legends. So I think some of it was there beforehand.
So in other words, it's not really too far out for us to talk about previous civilizations and them being gone, and maybe we might lose this one, but the spirituality and everything will continue, mankind will still.
Well, I think consciousness and we as manifestations of the consciousness in some form would continue on, and we may be in that sort of a cycle right now. I hope we're not. I mean, I hope we're going to prolong it for a while and get our act about, together better.
Yeah, I understand. But so the whole thing here is they've been here forever.
Been here as long as we have, practically.
And they'll probably be here after we're gone or somewhere.
Well, I'm hoping, you know, Jerry, I think I'm hoping that we become, before we close this cycle out, truly galactic citizens. I mean, citizens.
So you're still optimistic?
I'm optimistic. I think human mind, the human spirit, can actually take some steps to bring this divided species that's so fragmented today back together. And if we do, we can make the next step, both inner consciousness and external exploration, to expand into the solar system, into our, at least our galaxy, and join a community of beings, conscious beings, who are obviously active in our universe.
You know, some of the, back to the original conversation about early myth and early fact and how it kind of gets intermingled. It seems to me that a lot of things, humankind, I guess is the best way to say it, we're always anxious to point in things in an evil or nefarious direction. Have you ever noticed that?
We
may not even be there.
That's right. Well, what I'm suggesting is that's a perception. I mean, in a universe, it's a self-learning universe like ours. You have construction and destruction. You have positive and negative forces. But what we do to learn from those experiences is what's important. And I think that the human species is a self-learning species, and we can learn from these mistakes. And
what do you got in the future? Another book?
Well, I'm working on something now that I'm calling The Four Modes of Spirituality. You asked me whether I had a religion. I said, no, I don't have a religion, but I have spirituality.
Yes.
I have a natural spirituality. But I think on the planet we've got a spectrum from supernaturalism to mystical, magical thinking to the real dyed-in-the-wool, physical materialist who thinks only in the five senses and what you can touch and feel. And then I think you have a natural spirituality which sees the whole universe and all of these beings and all of these dimensions as a part of one natural whole. And what we have is a creative force, source, by whatever name you want to use. I don't use the name God because it has this connotation of beings coming down from the skies, which is where the word God came from in Sanskrit and Old High German. Same as Deus in Greek, Dios in Spanish.
All kinds of, even in the Hebrew alone, I mean, there's Yahweh and Jehovah. I mean, are we talking about two different people there or what? We don't know.
Well, Yahweh and Jehovah were the names for one of these beings.
Yeah.
And if you look at the Bible, it talks about the plural gods, the Elohim. And then it talks about the Anakim and others.
I know when you came on the show, you didn't know we were going to talk about the spirituality and the Christian aspect of this. But the thing that troubles me, and I've never heard an answer, and trouble's not even the right word, most religions and even spirituality certainly is built upon one. Why couldn't it have been a committee?
Well, it could have been a committee.
Yeah.
But you see, I'm opposed to the idea of deifying and making into divine beings any of these beings. So I would go back to the early oldest Atman, which was the Hindu tradition,
yes.
The use of Atman, Ashura, Allah.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Hebrew tradition that got caught up in the Yahweh mode. If we go back to the idea of oneness, allness, almighty, to me that's the concept of God in nature, nature in God, it's one and the same. I mean, we're just little manifestations of that central consciousness.
And I certainly agree with your premise that you take even today, I'd start to say prehistoric man or earlier civilized man, today you can take it right here in Eureka Springs, a guy driving down the road here tonight, and he runs across an extraterrestrial or something, he's likely to get a religious connotation out of it.
Well, it depends on his worldview. Uh-huh. See, if he's a religious person, he'll say, oh, I saw an angel.
Or he might have seen a devil.
Or a devil, depending on whether he thought it was positive or negative. But if you're a participant at this conference, you'd see that same being, and you'd come and say, I saw an E.T. And that's why I'm using the word advanced being and ABs to sort of level the playing field so that we don't give a pejorative or overly positive definition. We just take it neutral. You know, it's a being more advanced than we are because it can disappear and appear. It can talk to us or choose not to talk to us. And that's the only thing. Not necessarily more moral, not necessarily more spiritual, not necessarily more, you know, ethical. I mean,
yeah, we're reading things into things that are maybe not even there.
We're projecting our own needs, our own interpretations on the experience.
And we, in everyday life, run across several people. Well, I didn't mean that when you're talking
exactly,
to
exactly.
And you didn't, but they tell you that.
Or you meet a person for the first time, and you just immediately form an impression, that person is a nasty guy, you know?
Yeah.
And then you realize, hell, he's just like I am. He's a nice fellow, you know?
Right. Paul Von Ward, it's been a pleasure. Anything that you'd like to bring out I haven't talked about?
Well, I just think I would like to encourage people to get in touch with my website, if that's appropriate.
Oh, well, of course it is.
It's just simply www.vonward, that's V with a Victor, O-N-W-A-R-D.com. And I have on that website, I have this little questionnaire about consciousness quotient for people to sort of rate themselves and see what their level of conscious awareness is of this multidimensional universe of ours. And I'm also working on this, as I say, the four modes of spirituality. And people who'd like to do a self-assessment to see sort of where they stand in terms of supernaturalism and mystical.
And they can do that on your website.
They can get in touch with me on the website and do it. And I don't mind email messages, just paul@vonward.com. And
okay.
It's a good way to get in touch.
And we have that on our website,
too.
A link over to it with this interview.
That's great.
And I'm interested in how the survey goes.
Yeah, well, I'll let
over,
you know.
Over a period of
let
time.
You know.
I imagine what you first get 2 months later when you get more people inputting might change completely.
Well, the reason I want to announce it on programs like this is to get as many different groups.
Right.
Because to make it work, you've got to have people who have all these different worldviews. And when we have enough of a sample, then we can sort of see how we stack up as a society.
So basically, you're optimistic.
Absolutely. Still optimistic.
And the ABs are not necessarily good or bad.
I see them as a neutral, you know, it's like other humans, good, bad, positive, negative.
Have you ever run into one yourself?
Well, you know, that's a long story.
I got a couple of minutes.
Well, I had two friends when I was a young child. You know Whitley Strieber's book, Secret School. I had two teachers. I can tell you their names. Woke and Wokum. And I would come out of the woods. We lived out in the country and farm. And I would come out of the woods and I'd tell my parents about, you know, my friends. And it was very interesting because they were country folks, farmers, but they didn't make fun of it. They accepted it. They told my aunts and uncles. And
that is interesting.
And later on, you know, when I was a teenager and even as an adult, they would from time to time remind me of that. So that was my first introduction to what I would call ABs. Know the term at the time, of course, but I just called them Woke and Woke 'em.
You haven't been back there to see if they're still there?
I haven't been back there. That farmhouse was burned down 40 years ago. I've been back there. But I've had a few other experiences and many paranormal experiences.
Well, next time you're on, we'll be talking a little bit about those and a little bit about your latest project.
And look forward to it.
And the book and the website, they're mentioned on our website at jerrypippin.com if you're a radio listener. It's God's Genes and Consciousness. It's available.
It's available online and from the publisher. And on my website, you go to the home page, click on the publisher, and you can see the event schedule where I'm going for conferences and talks and lectures and also the books there.
Oh, it's been a joy.
It's a pleasure. I'm delighted to meet you and take part in this. It's wonderful.
Okay, thank you very much. We've enjoyed it. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Our own location producer is Roberta Scott.
David Rudiak was speaking on an incident at Nellis Air Force Base. By the way, David, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
What happened there in 1994, exactly?
Well, the Nellis Range is about 100 miles northwest of Las Vegas. That's where this incident occurred. And the range is the area where the Top Gun pilots from Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas go out and practice. And so they practice bombing and shooting missiles and evading missiles and that sort of thing. The area is covered with TV cameras and radar and communication towers where they monitor what the pilots are doing, and also to keep people out and make sure they don't wander in by accident. So what happened out there is back in November of 1994, one of the cameras got an object that they couldn't identify right on their video camera, and they're zooming in on it and trying to figure out what it is and calling the central controllers and asking if they know what it is. And this object apparently senses that somebody's looking at it. So we get, you have the tracking data on the video. You have good views of this UFO. It starts 10 miles away, but it comes within about 2 miles of the camera. And so you have this very unique piece of footage. It also includes the comments of the operators out there, because they're trying to figure out what it is, and they're pretty excited and pretty bewildered by what this thing looks like. It starts out basically a dot, but as it gets closer, you can see it has a dark bottom and sort of a white dome on top, and then as it gets still closer, all of a sudden these four more white lobes sort of sprout out of the bottom. So it's sort of a four-lobed object, and it seems to change appearance as it progresses along, and it's hard to get a fix on what exactly it looks like.
Is it a matter of perspective, you think, or is it was actually changing shape, or do you have a conclusion about that?
I'm not exactly sure. They Sightings TV did some analysis on this. They had a government contractor come in and take a look, and he claims it was actually changing. He spoke of it being kind of rubbery and the various parts of it moving around. There's also a very peculiar dark area in this object that you can see it wiggling around at the beginning, and then towards the end it starts glowing almost pure white. So it also seems to change shape. Sometimes it looks round, sometimes it looks elongated. So.
And you came across the video through Sightings or what?
The story with this is that somebody made a copy and they smuggled it out and they sold it to Paramount Studios in early 1995. And then it first appeared on a hard copy program. There used to be a program of that name. And they did a short segment on it, and then Sightings did one on it later December, and they did some analysis.
What is your experience as far as official tape like this, a video? Do you think there's a lot of that out that we don't see, or do you think this was an important occasion? In other words, is this a rare thing or what?
I suspect there's a great deal we haven't seen. The only reason we saw this is because somebody decided to smuggle it out and make some money on it. There are all sorts of stories of gun camera pictures taken from interceptor jets never seeing the light of day, and others, other sort of film that the government has just disappearing down into a black hole and never being seen again.
One of the things about this Nellis sighting that kind of got me my attention, that's not far from Area 51, the whole complex there. China Lake's not very far away. Of course, we know the government's highly compartmentalized, so maybe these people didn't know anything about saucer craft. Maybe the others did. I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of strange it was right there in that area.
Well, you know, the skeptics sort of acknowledge that the footage looks very genuine, and we can tell that it's filmed out at the range because we can identify one of the mountains in the background there. So the alternative theory is maybe this is a secret government project, maybe from Area 51, which is only about 40 miles away. And we know that whether they're back engineering saucers there or not, they do test secret aircraft like stealth. And the old U-2 was tested out there and developed out there, and the SR-71 Blackbird. So they do develop secret craft, top secret craft. Maybe this was another one. The problem is, according to the range operators who were interviewed, is that if they do fly secret craft out in their vicinity, they always turn the cameras off, and the range operators aren't allowed to see what it looks like or how it performs.
So this was a visitor just showed up. It was unplanned.
It just shows up, and they're contacting the controllers and saying, well, what have you got on that? Do you have a name tag or identity for it?
The controllers' diatribe that we're talking, did anybody have a radar fix on this thing?
There's some radar that we get off of this. I had to use other methods to determine how far away it was from the camera. But there are some radar returns. There's another segment. This particular segment I'm talking about is called the S-30 segment. It's some site called S-30. There's another one called S-13 where they have a continuous radar track on some sort of unknown object, but you can't really see what it looks like. It's just too far away. And so you're able to plot a trajectory from this, and they're also calling the control and saying, what have you got on this? We don't know what it is. It's not supposed to be here. And they finally, and they're calling up various stations, finally they get back to them and say, we don't know what it is. And one of the operators also comments that it doesn't have any sort of electronic military signature, a non-military electronic signature. They're not.
So that would eliminate that ours, unless they don't bother to put those on secret aircraft, and I don't know myself.
Well, I think one of the stories the skeptics cite is how when they were developing stealth, they decided to see how effective it was. So they did fly it over a radar site and see if anybody paid any attention to it, and they didn't tell them about it, and I guess they didn't notice it, and they thought that was a pretty good test of the effectiveness of the stealth. So they argue, well, maybe they sent some secret craft out there just to see how people reacted to it.
Well, in your research, what do you think? These government craft, I think it's a kind of a mixture of both out there, but I don't really have much proof. You probably looked at it much more in depth than I have. Is this situation in this area especially a mixture, or is it all government stuff, or none of it's government?
Well, I think these things go back too far for them to be all government stuff. Of course, you know, if they have recovered crash material and have done some back engineering, possibly they've learned a great deal about these craft in the last 50 or 60 years. And, you know, you can't totally rule out the possibility that they have craft that perform in a similar manner, you know, to some of these other craft. But, you know, people were seeing craft like these 100 years ago. There's a Scientific American article, I think, from 1882 where a South American, one of our diplomats to some South American country writes about this incident where a family, this bright light lit up their house, and then from his description, it sounds like they were suffered from radiation poisoning. Their skin fell off and their hair fell out. And this is 1882. I mean, this is a real story. This is 50 years before anybody even knew about radiation poisoning. Yeah.
So you got an interesting point there. What are you up to these days? What's happening in your life as far as, you got a book about UFOs or something coming out?
Well, actually my chief interest is the Roswell crash, and I've done a lot of research into that. I'm still hitting the archives looking for different news stories that were published at the time. In fact, I'm heading out from here and hopefully hitting some other microfilm archives and seeing what the stories are, and as reported in different newspapers. There's also a famous photograph of General Ramey, who was the one who...
I wanted to talk to you about this.
Yes.
What about that photograph? He's holding up that paper. What's it say?
Well, I've done the most study of that photo. It's been blown up. It was taken by a very high-quality press camera back in 1947. And so there's a 4x5 negative, which still exists. And so we're able to blow up that photo, and various people have taken a stab at reading what's on it. And I've put the most time in it, which I think is why I've progressed as far as I have. The key thing are two phrases in the memo. One says talks about the victims of the wreck, and another one talks about something being in the disc that they're shipping on. And so I think that's sort of damning evidence that there really was a crashed disc. General Ramey's calling it a disc. I mean, he uses the word. It's very clear, and that there were victims associated with it. With it of some type. He doesn't call it a spacecraft. He doesn't call it extraterrestrial. He doesn't say the victims are aliens, but something obviously much different than a balloon crash happened out there.
Of course, and they say, well, why would a general hold up something like that? Well, back then, nobody dreamed that technology would allow you to blow something up like that.
Well, actually, there were four photos of him taken and by the same photographer in that photo session, and three of them...
Was this a press photographer?
This is a press photographer. Photographer from from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Mm-hmm. His editor sent him out there, and Ramey thought this would be a good opportunity, I think, to spread the weather balloon debunking story. He had an old torn-up weather balloon in his office for the guy to photograph. But in these photos in which Ramey appears, there's four of them that we know about. He's holding this message in his hand, and three of them are turned away from the camera. And on one, it looks like he's sort of flipped his wrist a little bit to steal a glance at it again. And it just by chance, the photographer happened to catch an angle on the message as he was taking a look at it.
Well, I could understand how that would happen. He gets something that's pretty important, a memo, but he's still got the press in there, but he just got a peek. I can understand how.
Well, you know, the skeptics say, well, that never would have happened. He never would have allowed that to happen. But we know of instances where people who should know better have messed up. And one famous instance is during the Johnson administration, his national security advisor was McGeorge Bundy, and the New York Times went in to do a story on McBundy, and they had a photographer there, and in one of the photos, he's holding a binder in his arm, and the photo, which appeared in the New York Times Sunday magazine, clearly shows the title of this document, which turns out to be a very secret, top secret name for, you know, this was during the Vietnam War area. I think it was Top Secret Umbro, which is itself a top secret, this very name, which had to deal with secret documents concerning the Vietnam War. And there was another photo in this very same story where they taken pictures of papers on his desk, and I'm sure some of those were pretty sensitive as well. So this stuff can happen, and it's from people you think would know better.
I imagine that's what you look for in your research when you spend a lot of time in libraries reading press reports and things. You never know what you'll run across.
Well, for example, when people just think there was like only one Roswell story from the Roswell Daily Record, but there were all sorts of Roswell stories. There was Associated Press stories in Mayberry, and there were United Press stories, and there were Reuters stories. And so when you look at a lot of newspapers, you see that the press agencies were covering it from different angles, and you get a little bit different information. For example, in some of the stories, they're quoting General Ramey as saying that the object would have been, and presumably he's referring to this weather balloon, would have been 25 feet across if reassembled. And you look at this debris, which you know is only 4 feet across, these radar targets, and you say, where did he get this 25-foot figure? But then you hear from some of the witnesses who said they saw the disc, and they're also using this 25-foot figure to describe the size. So you wonder if maybe he sort of put that out there as sort of a hedge bet in case the story leaked out that the object that they recovered really was 25 feet across. And this would be his explanation. Oh, it's just a reassembled, you know, weather balloon.
This is Jerry Pippin. We're at the end of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs with David Rubiak.
So you're going to do a little research here in the Midwest before you leave, huh?
Right. Well, you know, there are other UFO...
I noticed a little prying question there. I'm trying to figure out what you're looking at.
Before I came down to this conference, I went to the... there's a main microwave or microfilm archive in Columbia, Missouri. I flew into St. Louis, and I went over to Columbia, which is nearby. And so I was looking for more Roswell stories, but I'm also looking for stories from other periods, which might concern the Midwest. There was a rumored flying saucer crash at Cape Girardeau
right,
in 1941. So I looked at the Cape Girardeau paper.
Find anything there?
No, I couldn't find a thing.
Yeah, okay.
There's not a hint of anything in the news. You know, there's some neighboring newspapers, and I looked through this time period when they think it happened, and I couldn't find anything. So something happened. It never made the papers.
Of course, that doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it makes you wonder why this 1941 Cape Girardeau story surfaced all of a sudden.
Well, a woman came forward. There was a fellow who was sort of considered the dean of the crash saucer collectors, and his name was Leonard Stringfield, who died, I think, back in 1995. And somebody came to him, a woman named Charlotte Mann, and she says her father had been a Baptist minister, and the military had grabbed him, you know, one evening and taken him out to this crash site, I guess, to administer last rites to these beings. And he came back and told the story, and apparently one of his, somebody in his congregation who was a photographer was taken out there, and he took a picture and gave it to the family. And she says that was in the family for many years, and it was given to her father, and somewhere down the line it got lost, of course.
Yeah.
But it was supposed to show these dead beings. And so that's where the story came from. That's pretty much all we have to go on.
Well, it's too bad you didn't find something in the paper there.
Oh, yeah. I was hoping the photograph would have been on the front page of the newspaper. But sometimes you get lucky, but usually you're not that lucky.
Well, I remember growing up in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and seeing a headline in 1952 about UFOs over Washington, D.C., and the actual picture of the thing over the Capitol. So it does make papers sometimes.
Well, there's actually a pretty famous photograph from the Roswell period taken by an amateur photographer over in Phoenix of a craft that witnesses say it was very similar to what was recovered at Roswell. It's got a scallop shape, and it's not a true circular saucer. It's rounded in the front, but it's got the scallop shape in the back. And he got three fairly good photos of it.
Are you going to be down in Roswell again soon? Or
I've only been there once in my life. I was there... I guess 3 years ago, and I was...
Now, that picture actually, I guess, surfaced, wasn't... Where'd you find that picture? Did somebody know Paso or somebody come up with that, or was it...
Oh, the Ramey photo?
Yeah, right.
Oh, that was actually in many newspapers back then.
Yeah, okay.
The Associated Press bought it, bought rights to it, and so you see it in many, many newspapers from that era. But the Star-Telegram held on to it, and then they passed their photo archives on to the University of Texas.
Okay.
So it's at the University of Texas in Arlington in their special divisions special collections division. And you can go there and look at it yourself, or you can order prints, you can order enlargements.
Well, I think the whole point was that even though you're an expert on Roswell, you don't have to be there much to find out information.
Well, not really. You know, I'm not so much a field investigator as some of these other people who are amazing. They go out and they interview hundreds of people. I tend to go to the archives, and I tend to collect what other people collect and try to put all the pieces together. You know, so I think of myself more of an analyst rather than a field investigator.
You have CIA experience?
Not that I know of.
I have enjoyed it. All right.
That was an interview we did with David Rubiak. Very interesting fellow. We did that back in 2004 at Eureka Springs, Arkansas, at the Ozark Conference, the Ozark UFO Conference, coming up this weekend, as a matter of fact. So if you're in that area, you might plan on attending. It's one of the better conferences. Grant Cameron was there that year, and we got Grant on the air as well. And Grant discussed a little bit about how he got interested in presidential UFOs. In other words, how the presidents knew, if they did know, anything about UFOs. And that search has taken him in person to every presidential library. And he's done hours and hours and days of research at each of these libraries. And he finds some gems, some pretty interesting things. Grant Cameron and David Rubiak, both very, very good researchers. By the way, we have an interview with them from Roswell that is a classic. And if you'd like to listen to it sometime, it's on demand, either as a Windows Media version for PC users, or you want to download it for your digital device. We have it as a podcast MP3. All you have to do is go over to jerrypippin.com and enter in the search engine Grant Cameron or David Rubiak. Either way, and that interview will come up. But right now, let's feature this classic interview from 2004. Grant Cameron explaining how he got interested in the subject of presidents and UFOs.
Yeah, I figure my 25 or 30 years of working at this, I found that lots of times people either believe you or don't believe you, so I figure you might as well have a little bit of humor with it and sort of not take it so seriously. But yeah, the thing at Las Vegas with the presidents and the crash flying saucers was something that was well received, because a lot of people don't really realize how much the presidents were involved and the fact that they're like common people like you and I and are very interested in psychic phenomena and UFOs and want to sort of figure what's going on. The thing is to try to get the material out of the presidential archives and find out exactly how much did they really know.
Well, if I remember, that was back in November, but I think it went back to Roosevelt at least.
Yeah, Roosevelt was the first one I started with, and I just picked that stuff up recently, and actually got another story here about his interest in the phenomena. And Eleanor was also very interested in UFOs, and actually had done some interviews with people who had UFO sightings.
I think she had a radio program or something.
Yeah, she had a radio program, and there was two pilots from Arkansas, a very famous case back in 1950. And she actually made the move to get these people on her radio show and said she wanted them on her TV show, whatever it was that she had, and interviewed these two guys. So she had an interest in it, as well as the president, who was also interested in astrology and psychic phenomena and stuff like this. And I spent a lot of time trying to get material, and bits and pieces come out. Each conference I go to, I pick up another few stories that I'll head to the whatever presidential archives is involved and try to track down the story.
And the interesting thing, you know, since we're here in Arkansas, I guess I want to ask you, I always hear the story about Bill Clinton trying to get some information. In fact, the story I always hear that he asked Hubble, that's the reason he gave Hubble the job, to find out a little bit about UFOs. Is there any truth for that?
Yeah, there is truth to, he asked Hubble to find out two questions: who killed JFK and are there UFOs? And Hubble was actually asked about it later by a guy who was doing a UFO documentary. And at that point, then he sort of shot up and said, everything that I know that the president asked me, I put in the book, and you'll have to ask the president yourself. But Clinton and Hillary is actually, according to the research I did, Hillary was even more interested in the phenomena than Bill Clinton was. And I had talked to a fellow who was attached to the CIA, who told me that even before they came into Washington, they were rumored to be looking for stuff. And Bill and Hillary spent a lot of time, didn't get very much success because they were Democrats. And what I found is that Democrats generally don't get as much material as Republican presidents, because they're not tied into the military-industrial complex like a Republican president would be. But the Clintons were very, very interested. There's actually two researchers that I know of who were contacted. One was William LaParle, who claimed that Hillary had tried to contact him to get material on UFOs. And the other one was, the name is escaping me, Daryl Sims had done research on implants, and some of his tapes had gone to Hillary Clinton,
on that he had produced VHS tapes. So they were very, very interested. And in fact, Bill made a number of statements. If you recall back, Ronald Reagan had talked about the alien invasion. Bill Clinton also talked about the alien invasion and made a number of comments, which I put in an article. And there's actually probably 15 comments where Bill talks about people on Mars or UFOs or different things, and seemed to be very, very interested. In fact, even talked about the Roswell crash in a very famous speech that he made in Belfast, Northern Ireland. He actually referred to the Roswell crash, and it was something that I always tell people when I lecture, that you've got to realize that a presidential speech is very planned. It's not something that they just talk off the top of their head. It usually takes weeks or months to write a speech, and it's all signed off. And in this case, he had received the Roswell report, a story that most people don't know. He received the Roswell report, the first one, in November of 1995, went to Belfast, Northern Ireland, to make this speech, and made this reference to a letter that he'd received from an Irish boy by the name of Ryan. And he said to him, "Ryan, if you're out in the audience tonight, here's the answer to your question. No, as far as I know, a UFO did not crash in Roswell, New Mexico." And then he said, "If the U.S. Air Force did recover alien bodies, they didn't tell me about it, and I want to know." At that point, the Air Force had to go back and do a second Roswell report, which they brought out in 1997. And that's the report where they talked about the bodies. And it was a direct answer to the president of where were the bodies. You didn't describe the bodies in the first report, and then they had this crazy story about dropping dummies and people confusing. So Clinton, but you see how it's done indirectly. The president doesn't directly talk about it, but indirectly in a speech, and if you pick it up, you know what he's talking about and why it happened.
Yeah, in fact, you've been doing a lot of work in that area, and you're absolutely right when you talk about that. It's strange. They seem to be talking past each other on purpose.
Yeah, exactly, and then you have to sort of read between the lines, and then you have to go and try to find the documents that support that case. In fact, this morning, an interesting story, after I lectured this morning and I talked a bit about the presidents, a woman came up to me and said that Bill and Hillary Clinton may actually have seen a UFO, and so she's going to write me, and her sister owns a restaurant in Arkansas, and Bill and Hillary Clinton used to eat there all the time, and apparently the sighting was there. And she's not 100% sure whether Bill was at the sighting, but there was a number of Bill and Hillary's close friends who saw the object, and she knows for a fact that they talked to Bill and Hillary Clinton about this, and she figures that may be where Bill and Hillary got the interest. Yeah.
How about world leaders in general, besides presidents of the United States? Other places, do you think they have as much information or less or what?
But that's a hard question. I think the Americans have more. Like, I know I'm from Canada, and the Canadians got out of UFOs about the same time as the Americans. And very rarely did you ever hear these rumored stories out of Canada. I know the Canadian Prime Minister, who in the 1960s, his name was Lester Pearson, actually won the Nobel Peace Prize. And during his Nobel Peace Prize speech in 1957, he actually referred to the Martian invasion. And this may be where Ronald Reagan got the idea about the alien invasion, because he said how if we were invaded from Martians from Mars, the world would be united. And this was in his Nobel Prize winning speech in 1957. He later became the Prime Minister of Canada.
Sounds like he might have been giving a message, talking past people.
Well, yeah, exactly, except that at that point he wasn't the Prime Minister. In the 1960s, he did become Prime Minister. And when the big flap occurred in Michigan in 1964-65, whenever it was, when J. Allen Hynek was involved in the whole swamp gas story, the Canadians were having sightings on the other side, and he had then become Prime Minister, and he asked for a UFO briefing, and he was actually the fellow who was the defense minister is still around and did confirm, yes, we probably did give him a UFO briefing. So the Canadians were interested. Churchill had, there's a famous quote that Churchill had written a letter, a memo in, I think it was 1951 or 52, and he said, "Somebody tell me what's going on here about flying saucers." But again, it comes down to trying to get the material out and finding out, because most of these briefings are done off the record, and because for them it's an embarrassment type situation as well. You want to be known as the president who believes in flying saucers or this sort of stuff. For example, Ronald Reagan, the story was told and a number of times about Ronald Reagan that he was very interested in a number of subjects like ghosts. He was interested in Armageddon. He was interested in UFOs. He was interested in all this sort of stuff. And they actually had people inside the White House who would screen Ronald Reagan when he was with school kids. They would pull the school kids, pull Ronald Reagan away from the school kids, because the school kids would tend to ask these type of questions about UFOs, ghosts, and all this sort of stuff. And Ronald Reagan had no reservation about talking, and he would just talk. And like his press secretary had said, you know, the goddamnness things would come out of his mouth. They just couldn't believe what Reagan was saying. And they actually had people that protected the president against saying this kind of stuff out in the public to embarrass them.
Now, what about the Reykjavik story of talking to Gorbachev about
did that
happen?
Well, that's the thing. That's one of the stories I'm trying to track down. That's an incredible story if that did happen. I know they did make the comment that Reagan, the first alien invasion remark that he made, was actually made in Geneva with Gorbachev. And he made the statement, and Gorbachev did respond back about the alien invasion. He said, I think it's too early to talk about this, and made some other comments. But there was actually this exchange in speeches.
So in other words, Gorbachev didn't chuckle or dismiss it as a joke.
Exactly. He didn't dismiss it. In fact, in one of his speeches, he replied back about this alien invasion idea to Ronald Reagan. But Reagan and him, I guess, in closed doors, I looked at the National Security Council files trying to find those behind-the-scene meetings to see if they actually did discuss it. And that's where I found the one toast that Reagan had brought up, the alien invasion remark, in Geneva with Gorbachev.
Well, Grant, we're going to talk a little bit more about presidents, and then we'll get to some other things here. But are you doing a book about that?
Yes, Stephen Bassett and I are doing a book, and it's in New York. It's with an agent right now in New York and being pushed around. And they're having some trouble. We're trying to figure out what the trouble is, because it's a book that you would figure would be jumped on right away. Stephen Bassett said there's some indication that there may actually be political pressure to stop a book like this coming out, because it does deal with Bush and deals with the interview that I did with Dick Cheney. So there's a lot of aspects that they may not want, or you may have the publishers in a situation where they don't really want to get into the libel, you know, trying to check, make sure that all this stuff was said.
Let's talk about the Cheney interview for a minute. I mean, he was on Diane Rehm's show, of course, and got a caller.
Yeah, in Washington. There's a number of these major people. Some of the stories that we get are off the Diane Rehm show. And he appeared on the Diana Rehm show, and I've been on with Jimmy Carter twice. And the first time I was on with Jimmy Carter, I was actually, they were going to take the question, and the show ended before I was actually able to ask him. And the second time, after 5 minutes, they came back and said, no, we're not going to take the question. And the question I ask all of them, which I think is a critically important question, for example, Jimmy Carter will always talk about UFO sightings and about his interest. I don't care. The only question I want to ask, if it's a president or a vice president, because these are the people who are running the show, these are the chief executive officer people that should know what's going on and should be briefed on the subject. So my question that I always ask is the question I asked Dick Cheney, because he was former Secretary of Defense, he was former Chief of Staff at the White House, he's the Vice President, and I said, Mr. Cheney, in all your jobs in the government, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? And if you have, when was it and what were you told? Now, this is just after he came into the White House, and I guess he was sort of caught off guard. This is the first time he went on a radio talk show, and I don't think he's been on a radio talk show since. He said, well, if I had been briefed on the subject of UFOs, it would have been classified, and I wouldn't be talking about it, which shocked me, because he basically admitted this subject is classified. And I say, if it's classified, that means there's documents. If there's documents, that means they haven't released the documents. And if they haven't released the documents, there's a cover-up.
And that's one of the things I was getting about. I wanted to bring that up, was the general question, how difficult it is to get some of these papers you're talking about. Some things seem rather benign, but the government seems to not want to let loose of it.
Yeah, or the papers aren't even there. They're doing it, say, in private. Or there's a story told about Bill Clinton as to whether the president is even in the loop. The story is told by Stephen Greer that Sarah McClendon, who was a longtime White House reporter right back to the Roosevelt days, had said to Bill Clinton, she was interested in UFOs, that actually brought Stephen Greer to the for this big news conference that she hosted this thing at the National Press Club. And she asked Clinton, she said, well, what's the deal? Why can't you do something about, why don't you do something about this UFO thing? And according to her, Bill Clinton leaned over and said, Sarah, there's a government inside the government and there's nothing I can do about them.
That was Grant Cameron, and that was at the Ozark UFO conference all the way back in 2004. Since then, we made good friends with Grant, and we see him quite often. One of the top researchers for sure. Another one of the great researchers that used to go to the Ozark conference regularly was Wendell Stevens, who passed away last year. And this is an interview back in 2004 as well, in which we talked to Wendell about his career and whether or not he had ever seen a UFO while he was a lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. Go ahead and let's listen to this.
Did you or did you not see a UFO while you were in the Air Force?
No, I never saw him while I was in the Air Force. I had one experience with a UFO airborne years after I got out, when I was delivering an airplane, a mail plane back east to Detroit.
And you actually had an experience there?
Well, I'll tell you, it was midnight, and I was beginning to make my position report over the radio beacon at Indianapolis. And as I was speaking on the radio, I saw ahead of me what looked like small blinking colored lights. It looked like if you took a ball of Christmas lights, squeezed them together into a pancake, and then put them out there in front of the airplane and turned it on. All these little colored lights were blinking all over the top and the bottom and all around it. And I was talking to the control people already. I said, who's out here with me? And they said, there's nobody out there with you. I said, there is somebody out here with me, and he's at my altitude on a collision course. In air, you have 1,000 feet separation. If you're going east, everybody's going at an odd 1,000 feet. If you're going west, everybody is even 1,000. You can't run into each other. This guy is coming west at 9,000 feet, so it's clearly a violation of regulation. So I said, he is out here, and he's at my altitude, and he's coming right towards me. And they said, we are not painting anything on the radar. I said, well, he's definitely there, and I've got to turn. So I made a right turn. You turn right to pass, let him pass on the left, and he turned to his left. We were on a collision course again. I turned more, and he turned more, and we're still on a collision course. So I rolled out to the left and back around again to get a better look at it. And I didn't want to have to go through the collision. And at that point where I rolled away and came back, he was silhouetted against a big sea of yellow light that makes up Indianapolis at night. Then I could see that it was a dark lenticular form of about 10% to thickness to diameter. A big one. He was bigger than maybe two or three Boeing 747s nose to tail between me and the city. And he's starting to make a turn to the right about 30 degrees and heading towards Chicago. And I made a turn to the right to get closer to him to see if I could get a better view. And as I did that, it started to speed up and just went shoo, and was over the right.
Just like that, gone.
Like that, was gone. Flew away.
And as far as to your knowledge, it was never painted on radar at all?
They said they never saw anything.
We're talking Wendell E. Stevens. We're talking about crashes in New Mexico, several right there in a close time span, and not all of them, most people don't know about. They know about Roswell, of course. As you said, they got all the publicity. Why so many in New Mexico? Why so many UFOs at that time period?
Well, that was a question that puzzled everybody, including the government people. They didn't know how to account for all of this. And we got a clue in 1978 in a contact taking place in Charleston, South Carolina, where another fundamental Christian believer, didn't believe in UFOs, but a fundamentalist Christian, was involuntarily abducted, taken aboard, and after he's been examined on a table and helped off the table and allowed to walk around the craft and ask questions, he says, why me? Why did you pick me up? And he still thinks he believes what his church believes, that they're devils. And they told him that they had examined 12 other potential close observances, is what they called the abduction, and that they put all the information in their computer, and it rationalized and selected the one that would contribute the most new knowledge to what they were doing. And that the computer selected Bill Herman, so they picked him up. Now, after he's aboard and had the examination, and he says, well, what do you want me to do? Why are you here? And they said, well, we have lost one of our craft to what we considered hostile action in the western part of your land, they said. And they said, we were hoping that somebody could contact your authorities and arrange to have them release our bodies and our residue to us. And Bill Herman said, why don't you do it yourself? And they said, well, we tried. We sent an emissary to Washington. He tried to get to the Pentagon. He was intercepted. They tried to capture him. He successfully got back to his ship, took off. They launched rockets after him, sent fighter planes to pursue him and to shoot him down. They said, they're too hostile. You can't deal with them. We were hoping that there would be a better way to do this. He said, well, I have no clout. I don't know anybody. I can't help you at all. He says, how did you lose it? And they said that they discovered after the fact that there was a beam that they thought was a beam weapon to begin with that was rotating in a circle out there, and it had could stop and lock on to an object. And when it's locked onto their vehicle and the lock-on lasted 90 seconds or more, it would cause the computer control system to fail and go into automatic emergency landing mode. So when we began looking for a beam that was doing this, we found that the Navy was trying to improve the radar that we had. See, when the British invented radar, it would only go out 25 miles. Then during the war, we improved it for the ships so they could look out 50 miles. Now the FAA wanted to join the radar, the field radars and ship radars in an umbrella radar, and they were trying to get out 200 miles. So the Navy was doing the research. They needed this too. The Navy was carrying the research ball, but it was being funded by NASA and other agencies trying to get 200-mile reach radar. And they were the experimentations were taking place on Mount Telluride in the Four Corners area up there just north of Roswell. It's in the corner for Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah come together, right there in the corner. All of the crashes came down within 200 miles of that. There was 10 crashes that happened there within a year.
Ten?
No, more than that. There were 10 that I know of.
10 that you've been able to find out about, and it was all connected with this new kind of radar?
We don't know, because most of the occupants were killed. There was a couple of them that survived at Aztec, but they were carried away, and we don't we believe now that they were taken to Los Alamos, where they had already begun preparing a habitat for any more that came down alive. And then a year later, one came down north of Kingman Air Force Base, 8 miles north of Kingman Air Force Base. And this was interesting because there were four surviving occupants in that one, too. The Army got on scene in time to take the occupants alive. They arranged to pick the vehicle up on tank transporters, and they hauled the residue to Area 51 and took the occupants to Los Alamos. So Los Alamos evidently successfully prepared a habitat, a habitat they could live in.
When we talk about the habitat, did they have some special, I guess they did, have some special requirements?
I think we were experimenting. We were trying to find out special requirements because they didn't have a lot of success in keeping them alive very long. But they did take the ones from north of Kingman to Los Alamos. Now, the interesting thing about that is, when they recovered the residue and took it to Area 51, it was beeping the whole time they recovered it. When they got it to Area 51, kept beeping, and the engineers couldn't figure out how to get in it, how to stop the beeping or anything else. And somebody says, why don't we send for the occupants? Have them come turn it off. They finally ended up doing that, and they called Los Alamos and had them send the occupants over. They drove them over in a carryall and indicated by signals and motions what they wanted done. The aliens indicated they would have to go aboard to do it. There was a big discussion about could they trust them if they let them go aboard. They finally sent a guard in with them and let them go in, open it and go inside. The guard came out vomiting and real sick, and now they're in there alone, and they're wondering if they're going to activate it and take off. When pretty soon they came to the door, the beeping stopped. And they came back to the door, and they back to carry all up, and they came down the steps, got the carry all, and they drove them back to Lothal.
One of the great things about going to these conferences, by the way, is you always run across a lot of experiencers, and one of the most famous experiences, I guess, is Leah Haley, who not only had trouble with ETs, but also with the black ops and U.S. government troops. I think you'll find this interview interesting with Leah Haley.
Leah Haley, here we are in Eureka Springs at the end of the Ozarks, and how are you?
I'm doing great today. How are you, Jerry?
Pretty good. We want to follow up a little bit on your stories because they're pretty amazing, and I want to get into the mind control that you talk about a lot in Unlocking Alien Closets. But first of all, before we even get into the UFO things, I love your little book on pet peeves.
Thanks. Yeah, it's called In Heaven, and actually it was an accident how I wrote that book. One day I was walking in the Kmart parking lot, and I stepped on a piece of gum, and just off the top of my head, I said, in heaven, I can walk anywhere I want and never step on gum. And so it became kind of a joke with my husband and me. Every time something would happen that irritated me, I would just say, in heaven, this doesn't happen. And he said, you need to collect these and put them all together in a little gift book. So I did that. So after I got more than 100 of them, written down over the course of a period of time, then I published that book.
Well, you got this is a great little gift idea and all kinds of little pet peeves, and they can order that off your website as well, I think.
Right. They can get that from greenleafpublications.com or Amazon. Any of the online bookstores have it.
And let's talk a little bit about your abduction experiences. It started as a child.
Yeah, the first experience that I can remember happened when I was about 3 years old, and my family was fishing at a lake in Alabama, and my dad got sick, and we had to row the boat to the shore, and my dad laid out on the bank of the lake for a while, and my brother and I were just running around playing at the edge of the woods, and I saw this odd-looking, what I called an odd-looking child inside the woods. But this odd-looking child had off-white colored skin and big black eyes and no ears and no hair and didn't look like any other child I had ever seen in my life. And he asked my brother and me if we wanted to go take a ride in his space. Well, he called it would you like to go take a ride in this big round ball type thing. And so I said, I can't do that. My mother would get mad. And he said, we'll make things all right with your mother. And so he led us into the woods, and we were beamed aboard the craft, and my brother and I were allowed to explore the craft. And after a while, we got tired and had to take a nap, and the aliens put us on tables, and next thing I knew, the aliens were taking us back to the edge of the woods to rejoin my parents.
And did your parents think you were gone for any amount of time or what?
Yeah, I've talked to my mother about this quite some time, and she wasn't aware that we were gone, so apparently the aliens did something to my parents to freeze that period of time so that they had no recollection of what was going on.
How about your brother? Did he recollect anything?
My brother did not remember anything because he was only a year old at the time. He was just barely walking when that happened.
Yeah, they would have had to freeze the time because your mother would have noticed a one-year-old was missing pretty surely.
Oh, absolutely. She was a very protective mother. In fact, no offense, Mom, but overprotective, so she would have been very, very concerned.
Well, you're not a stranger to people who watch talk shows. I remember back in the 90s, early 90s, you were on the Joan Rivers show.
Right, yeah, that was in 1993.
And you actually had a book out at that time, which is still available, and it's called Lost with the Key.
Right, Lost was the Key, and it talks about my abduction experiences through 1992, and These are experiences primarily with the creatures that have the big black eyes, but I've run into a couple of other creatures throughout the years, but those primarily, and also how at the very beginning when I started trying to find out what in the world was happening to me, questioning what was going on, whether I was going crazy or whether things were really happening, the military got interested in my case and started following me around. I started hearing odd noises on my telephone and being harassed by the black unmarked helicopters and that sort of thing. And so that's what that book talks about.
And, in fact, that's one of the things we're going to concentrate here on the interview with Leah Haley is we talked a long time in Laughlin, and then again we've had a phone interview as well. You really feel the government probably treated you a little worse than the ETs.
At the very beginning, they were pretty horrible. There was one situation where I had had an abduction experience and was dropped off in the field by the alien entities rather than being taken all the way home. And while I was standing out in the field, this helicopter landed in front of me, and military personnel carrying M16s jumped out of the helicopter, dragged me into the helicopter, took me to a military base, led me off the copter into a conference room where people were waiting for me to arrive, by the way. Of course, I'm kicking and screaming and uttering a little bit of some words that weren't very nice, really.
Yeah, you weren't ladylike like you normally are.
I was not ladylike at all, I'm afraid.
But you had an excuse.
Well, I wasn't concerned about excuses at that time. I really just let them have it, actually, and didn't do me any good. You know, I mean, they dragged me in there, and as soon as I was led into the conference room, somebody gave me a shot in my right arm, shoved me down into a chair. A woman wearing a blue Air Force uniform brought in a tape recorder and set it on the table. So I assume that it was interrogated, but I honestly don't believe. I mean, I don't remember what I was asked. What I do remember is a man dressed in a khaki uniform sitting across the table. Sometimes he was sitting, sometimes standing, and he was very, very stern, very mean, and he kept saying over and over to me, "You did not see a spaceship. Do you understand? You did not see a spaceship." And I said, "I don't care what you say. You know, I know what happened, and you're not going to shut me up." I said, "The only way you're going to shut me up is to kill me." And he said, very nastily, "If it's necessary, that's exactly what we'll do." So for about a year, I was scared to death, and I believed the threats, and I kept my mouth shut, and I looked over my shoulder all the time. I didn't trust a soul. I really absolutely was scared to death for about an entire year in my life, which is pure hell because of the fear. And then I finally decided that being afraid was no way to live. What kind of life was that, you know, that I'd just rather them go on and kill me than to be afraid. And then I started thinking, well, what right do these people have to keep this stuff quiet? You know, it's happening. It's truth. People have a right to the truth. And I'm going to talk about it. And if they kill me, so be it. But as you can see, you know, this is, what, 11 years, no, excuse me, longer than that. This is 13 years later. I'm still here. I'm still well. I'm still alive. And the threats were just idle threats. They did not kill me. They just wanted me to keep my mouth shut.
Now, so your message to other people who have experiences like this is don't let them bluff you?
Well,
Or not.
I'm not going to go.
You don't want that on your conscience?
No, I don't want that responsibility. All I can say is what my own personal experience has been, and I have received threats many, many times throughout the years, and the black helicopters flying over, which at the beginning they were to harass me, I feel, and I'm fine. I'm not taking responsibility for anybody else. They're going to have to do what their conscience tells them to do and take their own responsibility for it.
Now, you say you've had recent, you still see black helicopters, right?
Right. Now, the black helicopters still come over my house, but obviously since I've written books on this subject, and I lecture everywhere about it and do radio shows, and I'm not going to keep quiet. It is no longer an intimidation technique. Now I know what's going on is some of the times these copters are monitoring me, doing surveillance, and at other times some of them are doing mind control on me. And my husband caught them in the act of doing mind control on me in June of 2000.
So he came home unexpectedly or something?
Right. What happened there was I had had some kind of weird experience happen during the night around 4:30 a.m., and I told my husband about it. He wasn't able to go back to sleep, but I did after that. He had to get up at 5:30 to go to work anyway. So he got on up, and he got to work, left around 5:30 as usual. I was supposed to get up around that time and get ready to go to work, but I didn't feel very well that morning, and I laid in bed a little bit later than I should have, and while I was still lying there, I heard a helicopter approaching and come over our house, and it stopped and hovered over the roof of our house. And after it stopped, this voice came into my head that said, "You're too sick to go to work today. You have a headache. You're dizzy." And as I was told these things, I was feeling worse and worse and worse, and I became paralyzed and couldn't move.
And so you were actually hearing these voices, or was it in your head?
It was in my head, but I still could identify it as a male voice.
Okay, we'll be right back and find out about this. This is Jerry Pippin. We're talking with Leah Haley. And, of course, this is the UFO file.
Prince Anthony was the handsomest man in the entire kingdom.
Man, am I handsome?
His fondest wish was to find a beautiful bride.
Of course, she doesn't have to be as stunning as me.
But Prince Anthony couldn't find one. Why? Well, because he never left the palace.
Being this pretty isn't easy.
He spent all day lifting weights and getting his back waxed. And trimming and grooming and tweeting and tricking.
Perfecting perfection.
Meanwhile, his less good-looking but far more charming brother Benji found a bride. So did his rather unattractive cousins and even his flat-out but ugly Uncle Stanley.
I don't understand it. I am way better looking than any of them.
Unfortunately, none of the women in the kingdom knew this because none of them had ever seen him.
Not if they ever did.
But they didn't. So Prince Anthony spent his entire life all alone until he was old and toothless, bald and fat, saggy and rather flabby.
At least my back isn't very hairy.
You may have the best product or service in the world, but if nobody knows about it, you just have the best product or service in the world. It's called advertising, and it works. Your competitors know this. Why don't you? This message brought to you by this station, Adweek Magazine, the Radio Advertising Bureau, and the Famous Radio Ranch.
Well, Leah Haley has some incredible experiences. We're talking basically, I guess, these are government people, you think, always, or military, or what?
I'm really not sure. Just a minute ago, we were talking about the black helicopter that was over the roof of my house. Okay, what happened after, the voice was telling me that I was getting sick, and I was getting sick and paralyzed and couldn't move. Suddenly, the helicopter started flying away. And I thought, oh, that was nothing. That was just an airplane with engine trouble, But it was like a voice was telling me that, too. And at that moment, my husband came running into the house, yelling, "Leah, Leah, are you all right? Are you all right?" And I said, "No, I'm not. Why do you ask, and what are you doing home? You'd already left for work."
Sure.
And he said, "Well, I was driving to work, and I got sick. I got an upset stomach. I had to come back home." And he said, as I was approaching the house, I saw a black, unmarked helicopter hovering above the house, and I wondered what they were doing to you. And he said, "I made a rude gesture at it with my hand, and it flew off." So he said, "Now you tell me what they were doing." So of course, my husband scared the helicopter off. We have no idea what the occupants would have done had he not arrived when he did. And I really can't answer your question. I really can't say who was in the helicopter. I don't know who was doing it. I have no idea. I'm trying to find out, of course. I'm trying to do research, trying to find out who has the black helicopters. And And that
you're doing, how are you doing that freedom of information things and things like that, or what?
Yeah, I did. I exercised my rights under the Freedom of Information Act, and I've just recently received 3 CDs from the CIA on MK Ultra and Project Artichoke regarding their mind control research, which they admit to, by the way. So anybody who says that our organizations don't conduct mind control, you know, they're wrong. All they have to do is just exercise the Freedom of Information Act and get their own documents. They're there. In fact, the reason the CIA sent me CDs is because they have approximately 20,000 pages worth of documents on mind control.
So they're not dabbling in just a little bit?
Not just a little bit, no. No, they're not. Now, the official word is that their research ended in 1984, but there are quite a few people like me still having mind control done on them, and we know that it has not ended. So it has either gone deeper undercover, or a different organization has taken it over. Perhaps the CIA is not doing it themselves anymore, but somebody else is. So that's what I'm trying to find out now through my research.
Of course, you got to watch out when you deal with government agencies. They all want plausible deniability, so they keep turning things over to different people, so they don't know much about it.
Yeah, that's what they say, yeah.
And that, now, interesting thing about this whole mind control experiment is it mass hypnosis, or is it done by sounds, or you have any idea how they do this?
According to my research and what's happened to me, there's a variety of ways that the mind control was conducted. I know that there's evidence that there's some technological instruments used, maybe like radio waves and waves of different sorts. But then some of it is seems to be done telepathically too. In my research, I found some people who are able to do remote viewing, remote influencing, and projecting mind control that way.
So in other words, there's a lot more to remote viewing than just checking up on things. You think there's actually an ability of some people sitting in a room someplace to actually control people?
Yeah, there is evidence of that. One of the things that I've been doing recently is interviewing remote viewers and discussing with people who have gone through the formal remote viewing programs what can and cannot be done. So I'm learning a whole lot that way. And all of the ones that I've talked to have told me that yes, that mind control influencing can be done through those means.
Now you live in Tennessee now, so this last incident happened in Tennessee, correct?
Yes, that's correct. It did happen in Tennessee.
But before that, with the military, that was somewhere else?
With the military, that was in Columbus, Mississippi, near Columbus Air Force Base.
And then as a child, where were you?
As a child, I lived in Alabama.
So ever who is doing this can keep track of you?
They obviously have very deep pockets and a lot of technology and helicopters and personnel at their disposal. That is correct.
Now, when we talk about, your first experiences with, I assume you think it was extraterrestrial. It sounds like it to me.
Right. My first experiences seem to be really done by the aliens. And I think that most abduction experiences where people report alien abductions, I think most of them really are done by extraterrestrial type entities or other dimensional, something other than Earth. But there are some other people like me who have also had the government, military, or human abductors as well. But we're a small percentage.
You're listening to our interview. This is Jerry Pippin, and we will be right back. So, anyway, most of these people have had extraterrestrial experiences, but I understand from reading your book that maybe not all of these extraterrestrial experiences are what they appear to be.
Right. I had one experience where, and this is a conscious recollection, by the way, not remembered under hypnosis or anything, but what I remember consciously. Happened, I think, around 1995 or 1996. I was living in Tennessee, and I don't know how I got to this location. I don't even know where I was, but somehow I was taken to a place, and I was kind of drugged up, you know, felt like a zombie. I was standing in line with a bunch of other people who had been zombified, and I was trying to get my bearings, and I thought, oh, I know what this is. We've been abducted, and we've been drugged, and this is an alien abduction. And I thought, I wonder if I recognize any other abductee here. So I turned around in the line to see if I could see anybody I recognized. And at first I saw somebody who looked familiar, and I thought, oh, that's so-and-so. And then I looked again, and I thought, no, it can't be. That person is a little bit shorter and a little bit smaller than my friend. And so I walked up close to that person, and as I got closer and I was fighting the effects of the drugs, I noticed that it wasn't a person at all. It was one of those creatures with the off-white colored skin and the big black eyes. But then I saw the creature move, and the creature bent its elbows and bent its knees. And the real alien creatures that I had encountered in the past did not have joints like that. You know, their body movements were more flowing than that. So I thought, oh, there's something wrong here. And so I told myself to fight the effects of the drugs. And I move up even closer to get to the creature to get a better look. And I got right up in its face. And I noticed where the big black eyes were stitched onto the white fabric.
Literally sewed on there.
Literally sewed on there, and I could see the texture, the weave of the texture in the fabric on the face too. And I thought, oh my, you know, this situation here, it's real human people dressed up in alien costumes and doing experiments on us under the disguise of aliens. And so I thought, if these people realize that I've come to this realization that I'm in really deep trouble. So I told myself to turn around and be a good little subject and not cause any waves, or I'd no telling what would happen to me. So I turned around in line, and at that time the abductors started moving the line forward, and there was a transport device, like a tram. The doors slid open horizontally. We were herded on to this transport device. The doors closed. We went some distance, and then the doors opened on the other side. We got out, and that's where my memory ends. I can't remember anything else about the situation. But that certainly made me go back and look at all of my past abduction experiences again and re-examine some of my earlier experiences. And when I did that, and I looked back at some of them, and I had called it an alien abduction experience, but in two of them in particular, there was nothing really alien about it when I started examining it. You know, I described my surroundings as irregular rooms that looked like hospital rooms with the square rectangular layout, you know, regular lights, green surgical curtains separating one cot from another cot, and the aliens looked like humans. So that made me wonder, you know, how many of these experiences that we think are extraterrestrial experiences maybe are not. But still, so I've been researching this and talking to abductees all over the country, and it seems like most of them are real aliens, and it is a small percentage that's done by the human element. The researchers that have tried to research my case independently, they believe that the crash really took place. There is evidence that a crash actually took place around Navarre Beach in Florida in 1988, which matches what I had remembered. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were down there investigating something that was highly secret in a hangar in which a whole bunch of air conditioning was brought in at the same time. And there were other independent reports of UFOs being loaded on the flatbed trucks down there. And so there is some evidence
that it happened.
But I need more evidence than that to satisfy myself.
And you're still working on all of these things. I'm sure, Leah, we'll be talking to you in the future. You have fun in Washington, D.C. and in Maryland.
Well, thanks. It's been great seeing you again, Jerry.
And we'll for sure see you in Roswell. And that Bay Area conference is always interesting, too.
I look forward to that one. I've never been to that area before.
Oh, I used to live there, and so did producer Roberta Scott. So it's a nice area.
Well, it's good to see you.
Okay.
Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of JerryPippin.com.